It's time to pull up a chair at the Retro Computing Roundtable.
And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
Well, hello again to all our ooey gooey listeners. I'm Carrington Vanston, and I get to play host for this episode of the RCR, recorded Saturday, March 31st, 2012. Show 25 is alive. I'm joined today by the usual unusuals. First up, he's a military veteran and an inveterate militant. And, dear listeners, he has now interviewed everyone on this planet except you. Don't take it personally. It's just David Grealish. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks, Carrington. And I got the reference about episode 25 being alive.
I know, did you?
I got it.
Little 80s movie reference.
Mm-hmm.
So how's everything in David Land?
Everything is pretty good. It's hey, let's go back to weather discussion. Let's see, I'm looking out the window right now, and it's clear, and the sun came back out. It got overcast a little while ago, so it's a beautiful spring day in the greater Atlanta, Georgia area.
It's been freezing cold this last week. It's been beautiful recently, and then this last week it hit like, 4 degrees.
Really?
Which has no equivalent in Fahrenheit. Crazy cold up here, and it's killing me because I want to get out riding my motorcycle. So cold.
Well, we almost did not have a winter here. Seriously,
me too. Yeah,
Toronto
was fantastic. Okay, so before we get too far into this, let's talk about our other guest. Also, scooched up to the roundtable today is a fine fellow from Camp Commodore, but I'm going to try not to hold that against him. I'm going to fail, but I'm going to try. Of course, I'm speaking of none other than the alliterative Earl Evans. And as I welcome you to the show, Earl, I'm going to ask you the question that is on everyone's lips, and it goes as follows. Back at ground control, there is a problem. Go to rockets full, not responding. Hello, Major Tom. Are you receiving? Turn the thrusters on. We're standing by. There's no reply. I ask you, Earl, why did Major Tom not reply?
Because he'd moved to another dimension and was flipping back and forth between, what was it, a fetus and an old man?
Oh,
wait,
I'm
that's
sorry.
A different movie.
Sorry. I'm afraid that is incorrect. The answer we were looking for, Earl, was 4321, Earth Below Us, Drifting, Falling, Floating, Weightless, Calling Home. We would have also accepted because the line is busy.
4321.
Yes, I'm sorry, Earl. And with the episode, oh my goodness, someone mute David. With the episode barely begun, the score now sits at Carrington 1, Dirty Filthy Commodore Lovers 0. With that, I say, Earl, welcome to the show.
And I really have nothing to follow that up with except to say, comment allez-vous, mon ami? And,
well, mention the fetus, old man and, thing. That was that, yeah, was that 2001 Space Odyssey?
It was.
A lot of listeners probably don't realize we do attempt to work in both fetus and old man references into each show, but we're usually a little more subtle about it.
Yeah, this time I decided to heck with segues. I'll just throw it in.
What's cool is we were fetuses and we'll be old men.
I'm going the other way.
With any luck? Oh, you're doing the Brad Pitt thing.
Right. I have the hairstyle.
You're curious or whatever it was.
I am.
Hey,
so, Earl, how you doing?
I'm doing good. And as I was mentioning, the weather here is beautiful all of a sudden. It's like it was rainy and yucky this morning, and now it's bright and shiny, white puffy clouds. Very unusual for Portland. So it took every ounce of willpower to do the podcast and not run out for a bike ride. But, you know, I love you guys, so I'm here.
Yeah, and you got plenty of time. We're doing the show later today than we normally do, but what, it's still only, is it 2:39 there?
Right.
So you still have plenty of sunshine left. After we get off?
Yes. Well, with any luck, you guys still there?
What happened? Yeah, I'm still here.
You said with any luck and then went silent. And your luck was
with any luck, I have a lot of time. I'm sorry. Dead air.
With any luck.
We were fetuses there for a moment.
Okay, guys. I get to play host. I'm gonna do the power control. I'm going to rein us in, and we're going to go on to the items of interest / news, which should, according to our show notes, take 30 minutes. Let's see if we can do that. Oh, looks like the first bit of news is for me. Awesome.
Well, so, do we usually keep it at 30 minutes? I think that works out about right, isn't it?
I have no idea.
We always have that note there, but that's probably about right.
You put that note there, and none of us has questioned you. Someone should start timing it, but supposedly this will take 30 minutes.
You better stick to the schedule.
We all managed to tweet this first item, right? Because this was really cool.
I did tweet it. David, did you do the tweeting?
I didn't, because I saw it had been tweeted. It'd been
score now is
twice tweeted a lot.
To zero.
You did, Carrington, right?
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, I retweeted Carrington's tweet.
Right.
That's usually the best way.
So we're all there.
Yep.
So everyone else knows what we're talking about because you can't see it. It's the Prince of Persia source code has been found. Jordan Mechner, who is famous for being the originator of Prince of Persia, and he made Last Express and the who knows how to pronounce it game. I always say Karateka, but it looks like it's Karateka according to some people. That seems crazy to me. Crazy. The source code has famously been lost for years and years and years, but his Jordan Mechner's father found a box of old Apple II stuff in a closet when he was cleaning, and included amongst the discs was the original source code for Prince of Persia, which has now been sent to Jordan, and he's got somebody working on migrating it over to his MacBook Air or getting it off an old like the old ProDOS discs, which are no longer readable by Mac OS X. So they got to convert it over, and then it seems like his intention is to release it just as open source something. So that's really, really exciting. I'm dying to look at the code.
And it's awesome. In 6502 assembly language?
Yes, that's what it seems to be, yes. Wow. And so, yeah, like they're just because like I guess somebody recently in Jordan Mitchner's – we'll have a link to the website, and on his blog he was talking about how somebody ported Prince of Persia to the Commodore 64 – just from an Apple II memory dump, and they said so. This will know how to make ports and changes and stuff much much easier. I'm just dying to because it's one of the all time great games. I know it kind of came out right at the end of the Apple II, and I guess it was like the Macintosh version, other versions that sort of saved the project.
I was gonna say the first time I became aware of it was of course I was mostly in that circle, but in the Macintosh. And then I know it came out for DOS as well. And that's kind of when it really took off, though, in a big way, right? Or, was it pretty big on the Apple II?
I think so. I think it was the Mac one came out sort of first of that bunch. The Apple II was the original one, but since it took so long, it took, like, famously, like, years to make the thing, like, between 85 and 93 or something like that. So it's, like, 8 years in the making. But crazily good game. Like, the amount of graphics available, like the relatively low resolution, to have such smooth motion and stuff, and amazing gameplay. I adored that game from the first playing, and it remains one of my all time favorite games.
Yeah, am I getting confused, or did I read that Jason Scott was helping out on getting that source code translated?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Or archived. I thought I saw somebody tweet
his helper.
I remember seeing textfiles.com mentioned in some of those tweets. So I'm not sure why.
Okay, that's Jason.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the significance was of text files. I'm looking at Twitter now.
And it's not in our notes, but I believe that Last Express, which is another one of his games, has been announced for iOS. It hasn't come out yet, but it's going to be coming out later this year for iOS. So I'm really looking forward to that. That's a game that I played and really enjoyed on the Mac, but I never finished. It's a tough game. So.
Oh, here's a tweet from 2 days ago. From Jason Scott, which is at TextFiles, is his Twitter account. He says, okay, looks like I'll be helping at J. Mechner, along with some others, to get that code off his collection of floppy disks. Timeline unclear yet.
Is that how it's pronounced? Mechner? I always say Mechner.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. So,
get him on the phone. Let's ask him.
Which, that makes sense. But, of course, if you see the word M-E-C-H, sometimes it's, you know, mech. It's also referring to that way, so who knows?
This is true. Maybe he is actually a mechanical man. Exposed here on RCR for the first time.
Tech, right? Tech is T-E-C-H.
Yes, it is, David. Yes, it is. Okay, David,
what?
You and I are going to be quiet for a second while Earl tells us some exciting news about the pet.
Talk, Earl. Earl.
Yeah,
talk, Earl.
It is very
talk.
Exciting news. Okay, can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Speak, Earl, speak.
Yeah.
That was sick.
All right. So, see, that works. The Pet Serial Registry Project.
Like it.
It's a website. And it's actually a fairly Spartan website, but it really, you know, serves the purpose of trying to get everybody in the world who has a pet, functional or not, mm-hmm. to record the serial number, the model number, and post it on this site so we can kind of get a catalog of all the pets that are still out there.
I have to put
and I've seen this kind of thing for other styles of computers. It's interesting. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but I know I've seen stuff like this for, like, the Commodore 128s and for... I saw one for Apple. Is there one of these for Apple IIs?
Well, I know that there was Apple one for people. Apple I and then also for Altair.
Yeah, Apple II people are all joined with a sympathetic link that can't be understood by man. So we don't need to have something
cool.
like that. We just all know about each other. I noticed how
See,
Earl,
I knew it was like
work.
I see Earl Evans on the list.
I see Earl Evans, and it would appear that Bill Degnan owns 50% of the pets.
Yeah, I see that too.
Bill does own a lot of pets. And I know another guy who owns a bunch of pets, and I've been kind of poking him and saying, hey, you know, you should get your pets registered up there because, you know, it's pretty cool. So, so for Apple I's, that's kind of rarefied air. I mean, there's only a handful of those folks around the world, but I suspect – if I had to make a wild guess, there's probably in the neighborhood of 500 to 600 pets, I think, still out there kicking, maybe even more.
You got weird on audio there.
The serial numbers for this are all over the place in formatting.
I could not figure out what was up with that. Possibly it had to do with where they were manufactured.
But some of them are like, oh, yes, so, because the USA, like, they're just, and I guess it's different type. I don't know. It's weird how, like, they're just, like, there's no rhyme or reason for this.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Do you sound normal to each other?
Carrington sounds a little bit muffled.
Yeah, both of you sound muffled to me.
I guess maybe we're having a little bit of internet problems here.
Okay. Carrington, say something.
What shall Carrington say?
Wow, yeah, both of you sound muffled. Do I sound muffled?
Nope.
No, you don't sound muffled to me, but Carrington does.
Wow, should we reconnect? Because
sure.
if I'm recording, I don't...
Hey, but if we do, isn't that going to goof up your recordings?
No, I mean...
No, because we just start again.
See, now you just got good, Carrington.
Yeah, you came back.
And now you too. That's weird.
Then I say we soldier on.
Okay,
You guys always sounded good to me the whole time, so maybe it's a lack of bandwidth thing, but
weird.
For me, it sounded fine the whole way through.
Okay.
And we'll cut this off at 3, 2, 1, boop. So if you've got a pet, go over to the Pet Serial Registry Project. We'll have the link up in the show notes, and register your pets.
And I have a question
because
for you, Earl.
It's important to register your pets. You should even get them chipped.
You should get them fixed, too, really.
Yes, you should.
Spayed and neutered. Hey, do you see Bill Degnan's got a pet 2001-8, and then he's got a pet 2001N-16? Are these both, like, that original form factor version? Are those the original ones?
If you mean the chiclet keyboard, usually the N means it's not.
Okay.
Like, mine is a 2001-8N, and it has the full-stroke keyboard as opposed to the chiclet-style keyboard.
But that one, the 2001-8, that's an original one?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
So it's the chiclet keyboard that is the really collectible one, right?
Correct. And if you have one that's functional, but it was the first pet.
Yeah, but if I'm going to use
very
one,
first
I totally
computer
would want
out
the full one.
Commodore, if you don't count the Kim, which some people do, but if you don't, then the PET was the first, and it was the first, like, all-in-one computer that came out from Commodore, and so that one's the first one, so it is more collectible. It's the one I used in high school, too. I'd love to have one, but on the other hand, you're right. If you were going to be sitting there for a long time, it wouldn't be fun.
Right. Okay, the next item of interest was contributed by you, David. We've got the Apple Corporate Museum article. What's that all about?
Thanks, Carrington. This has been an article idea I've had for, the end of March, so at least for the 5 months. So basically, if you go to my blog, classiccomputing.com, the most recent entry is, the title is, Apple Should Have a Corporate Museum and Public Space at Their New Campus. So basically, my premise is to propose that, with Apple's new big flying ring type campus, that they should that people more than ever are going to want to go visit there. I mean, people want to visit their current campus all the time. I mean, there's not much you can do there. You can have a picture taken in front of the building and go to the company store. That's really about it. But plenty of people like to visit it. So I think they need to embrace the idea that this building, one of the last big projects that Steve Jobs developed and presented to the Cupertino City Council, yeah, it's a big deal. And some people are going to want to visit it, and they should consider that. So I propose they build a museum, not an archive, because Stanford University already has one of those, but a public place where people can visit, learn something about the company, be even more inspired by their history, and then as well as have, you know, the company store that's to the public, and then have it even maybe connect to a part of their cafeteria system, so it can be an entire venue for visitors. So that's it. I don't want to say too much more, because I want you to read the article.
Sure, totally. I think that they should have things like Disney World things, where you get in them and they wheel you, and they move you around. It should have some monorail or something
I did propose awesome. Doom buggies in the...
Totally. I mean, because lots of companies have some version of things like this. I even went down to the Hershey factory once, and you've got like a whole tour. You can sit in and it wheels you through it.
Really?
If Hershey can do it, then yeah, that was actually a very strange trip where I ended up sleeping in my car and weird microphone voice was coming from the... I was in a mall that was closed and I didn't realize. Anyway, it was a bizarre time. It was a strange time in my life, and I ended up in Hershey. So,
but the basic idea, so, and I mentioned this in the article.
I think it's a good one.
But when Steve Jobs, you know, came back to Apple, and then slightly after when he came back to Apple, and he kind of, I don't think he was the CEO yet, but he started, you know, he had a lot of power and push. You know, the company had already been building up to have a museum and an archive, and he nixed that right off the bat. No, we don't want to do that. He was the type of guy always looking forward, not to the past. So he said, you know, get rid of all this, send it over to Stanford, let them worry about it. And so there's an archive, Apple Archive at Stanford. It was in the news even somewhat recently.
Right.
So Steve Jobs wouldn't particularly be would have been in favor of this idea, but obviously he passed away, and I think that's why it's even more important that the company. Actually, to close this out, the big premise I make in the article too is that Steve Jobs is Apple's Walt Disney,
and they both had the same personality.
Well, and there's a lot of comparisons to be made there. But you know, Apple is not all about Steve Jobs, but he is, you know, still, you know, one of the biggest stars of Apple, and they need to sort of embrace that, and they sort of need to learn how to, you know, honor and treat one of their founders. And of course, their other founder is still alive. And I just think they need to have a place. It would also be inspiring for the their employees, not just the public. You know, your new employee come to Apple, you could go through this and look around and stuff. So anyway, I have also two original pieces of artwork that I drew up some ideas, and a friend
Tim
of mine
did
work.
Those, right?
Yeah. Tim Vandeval. And so check it out. I wanted to talk about it on the podcast. So just
I think if they had that, I suspect Woz would really get a kick out of pretending to be a wax dummy and standing there and then jumping out and scaring.
And then jumping out at you?
An audio
totally.
Animatronic.
Yeah. Woz would be all about that. You know it. Like he'd probably just give tours. It'd be his new job. He gives tours at the museum, talks about stuff, rambles on. He'd be awesome.
So, David, you and I talked about this, and I thought, of course, there'd be a cost for putting this in, but by the same token, there would be a PR value with this, that there would, like you say, be a place for people to visit when they came to the new Apple headquarters. And it seems like it would solidify people's connection with the brand. Like they could, you know, because a lot of the people that own Apple products today may have been too young to even have lived any of the legacy of Apple. Back to the Apple II and things like that, or, you know, some of them even ever having seen a first generation iPod, and to walk through and, okay, this is where Apple came from. And you know, I mean, we all know the story because we're geeks, but if you're just your normal average Joe, then something like this could be both educational and serve to make you feel even better about the stuff that you're using. So it's an interesting idea. I wonder if they'll consider it.
And actually, I took a lot of what you said to heart. I actually, so before I published this, I added something along those lines. So it's okay, I'll read that real quick. It's like three sentences here. So, so this is actually in response to you suggesting that. Let's see. This idea presents some complicated and serious planning issues for Apple in regard to access, parking, management, and security. It would absolutely be an additional and ongoing cost to them, but the PR value would be priceless. More people are going to want to visit this new campus, so why not better facilitate and manage it? Apple should own the experience and integrate it.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Now, what if you went to Stanford and looked at this archive, or can you even look at this
archive?
Yeah,
as far as I can tell, it's not open to the public. So it's kind of just buried away. And I don't know. Obviously, I think at some point Apple may want to allow some of that to come out, or maybe have an area rotated through the museum.
Reintegrate some of that, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just – but another premise or another thing I talk about too is so I think let's take some of the failed products of Apple, which we all
Apple
love.
Denies there has so, ever been any of those.
Yeah, and even some of the failed leadership, if you want to call it that, or you know, which you know, so 1985 to 1996, before while Steve Jobs was gone, to me, by Apple embracing those years, celebrating it, even if you will, and laying it all out there, it only better illustrates the Renaissance years, I call it, of 1996 to the present of the Steve Jobs homecoming. You know,
well,
it makes them look even better.
To illustrate some of the strength is that lots of companies that went through, if you could call it a slump like that, didn't ever make it out of the slump. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Most companies that put out something like the Pippin never recover.
Yeah, true. Okay.
And RIM, management from RIM could go tour that thing and try to say, what did they do that we're not doing?
I mean, or even hugely influential companies that are lost in the annals of history now, like DEC. You guys know I've been playing around a lot with the PDP-11, but mm-hmm. It's amazing how many innovations came out of the PDP-11, everything from Unix to even the VAX, which then gave rise to Windows NT, yada, yada, yada. But DEC themselves as a company went into that kind of slump sort of situation and then got gobbled up and they never came out of it. So that's what I'm saying. It's amazing that Apple made it through those years in the desert and still came out the other side.
I think right. That's why Apple's had all this cash and they're doing that dividend thing they've announced lately. I think part of having that hoard of cash is it lets you ride through things, it lets you get over stuff, it lets you make mistakes. You know, a lot of power in being a company with so much just cash lying around.
I'm going to get a dividend check. I decided I'm going to I am going to deposit it, but I will make a color copy of it and frame it. No, I'm going to get one because I have one share of Apple. Do you guys own any shares of Apple?
No, I do not. I'm way too wimpy.
One share is like $1,100 these days, right?
No, it's $600 though. I mean, so, yeah. But my one share is framed. I bought it from a company. I believe it's called OneShare.com. But basically, you buy a share of stock as art, so it's nicely matted and framed.
And, oh, cool!
So actually, here on my wall, I'm looking at it. I have one share of Disney. I have one share of Apple, and I have one share of Pixar, which of course doesn't exist any longer because mm-hmm. Disney bought it. So that's actually especially a collector's item.
That's very cool. I know on MacBreak Weekly, every once in a while, Andy Inokto will reference like what Apple products you can purchase for the equivalent of one share of Apple stock now.
Yeah, it's up to an iPad now.
Yeah, you can buy an iPad with one share of Apple, which is just amazing. Okay, so let's forge forward. The next item on our and we'll have just I should mention we'll have a link to the Apple Corporate Museum article, of course, in the show notes, as we will also have a link to this next one, which is in there for me to talk about, but I don't know a lot about it other than Mozilla. Should I have Shepion here? You could talk about it maybe. They have announced and it seems released a massively multiplayer game experiment. It's HTML based, very retro. Reason I bring it up is it's very retro. It's well, it's an MMORPG in a sense. It's and it runs through HTML5 and JavaScript. It's wickedly retro. So you can play by yourself or you can play with others. And it's sort of like a little mini 8-bit Warcraft. And they're just showing – I think it's mostly there to show off the power of WebSockets, which I've done very little with. But WebSockets is a way to get bidirectional communication between web browsers or browsers and a server rather. So – it's just you know, and they're just showing how hey see you could enable massively multiplayer games what have you. I think you only play in groups of 12 or something at a time in this, but it's kind of cool. And so if you're into the 8-bit look, big NES fan for instance, and you want to check out something that's sort of like a in a sense a little new Zelda, but it's browser based and can work in a whole range of browsers, basically lots of stuff that's HTML5 compatible, you can go check it out now. So it's over it's one of the Hacks projects from Mozilla, so it's hacks.mozilla.org. And we will have a link in the show notes about that. Have either of you guys played with this?
As first I heard of it. It seems
have
like
not.
It would be something more along the lines of Chrome, though obviously it doesn't matter. I mean, it works.
Nope.
You know what I'm saying? We're thinking how the Chrome has its own, what is it, like memory partitions or whatever, right. And more like an operating system kind of thing.
Yeah, and obviously being a Mozilla thing, it's like completely open source. You can get over on GitHub, you can get the server source code and stuff. And it's really just – it's sort of – what I like about it is if you look through the code, it really shows like how to use a lot of sort of the newest, you know, cutting-edge web technology, say HTML5, and like how to really use CSS3 and just like stuff like that. How to use local storage. Like, so it's a nice training tool if you're really trying to get into online game development that's maybe more browser based or something like that, or even just want to push your knowledge of web browsers. And the reason I bring up an RCR is the implementation. I think even if you're not interested in the how does it work aspect, you just want to play it. It's a new, totally available, totally free retro based game that will probably work on everyone out there's computer. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
So yeah, it's fun. Good across all platforms and mm-hmm. web browsers and, you know, mobile devices.
Yeah, basically, if you have something that can run HTML5 and JavaScript, it's going to work. So Firefox and Chrome and Safari and all that kind of stuff. But also iOS devices, like and like tons of things, and tablets and stuff. And so
run in IE9 also? I mean, I think IE9 is actually...
IE9 is surprisingly good, and I like the ads that it's the browser you used to hate or whatever, or you loved to hate something. I like those new ads. So anyway, new retro game run out there, and everybody should play. Not a lot to really say about it. The new game just came out a couple days ago, so I just thought it was a cool project.
Yeah, check that out.
So Earl, before you check that out, what else is on the net that's new and exciting you might want to talk about?
I mean, before you guys go anywhere else, really, you want to go to rcrpodcast.com because we've
every
got a new
day.
Website. Yeah, every day. We got a new website. We got a new blog that we're going to be posting entries to. And we
Yeah, where
also,
are the blog entries, Earl? Earl, who wanted a blog?
They're coming.
Don't get mad at me. I posted to my own blog. Oh, sorry.
I just see draft format stuff.
I should have posted to this blog.
Oh, the only post is by me, and I didn't even want to put a blog up there. But I will be blogging there as well. So as the three of us have things that are retro-oriented, so the new site is sort of bare bones at the moment. We might pretty it up or what have you. But the episodes, of course, most people just subscribe, and you can find them through iTunes. The easiest place to find how to subscribe to the show, if you've just come across it, for instance, is to go to rcrpodcast.com. And then on every single page on the right-hand side, you'll send links to both iTunes, if you want to subscribe through that, and also just the RSS file right away. But now we've also, of course, launched a joint blog with the three of us. And so we'll be blogging there the things that sort of catch our eye and our interests that have to do with retro computing. So I'm interested in that. So there's that. And also, in addition, of course, we're really I've been hanging out quite a bit in the Vintage Computer Forum now.
Which we have a link to.
I've been trying to get over there.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have Karen, there's something very familiar about this blog entry of yours. Not another retro computing blog.
Well, yes.
So and there is an RSS feed for the blog as mm-hmm. well as for the podcast. So
absolutely.
If you want to, if you're a feed reader kind of person and you want to tune in that way.
Feed reader.
Go feed reader.
I keep telling you, David.
No thing.
Yeah.
Go feed reader.
Friends don't let friends podcast. yeah. Anyway.
So yeah, so everyone should scurry over and check. We're hosting Squarespace, which is so much fun. I'm digging Squarespace a lot. They're not a sponsor. It's too bad they're not because
yeah,
we can talk about them more. And it's just it's managed hosting, and it's so pleasant. I moved my own blog over to that a while ago, and the new Monster Feet stuff is going to be on that as well when it launches. So 1 MHz and the new podcasts and Double Taken, all of it's on Squarespace. I really really like it.
I found it surprisingly easy to mm-hmm. get the RSS feed for that blog, to put that link over in the navigation area on the right.
Because you had never even used Squarespace before, right? You had never used
that.
I just did a login and bingo, suddenly you're modifying it. Like, just anybody, if you don't know anything even about web stuff, you could do it. Like, it's really nice. I like it.
I agree.
So, David, what's the next thing up? I think you want to tell us about some upcoming vintage computer shows.
Hey, I'm going to do that, but while I'm thinking of it, I just want to add, Earl, do we have any interesting listener feedback?
One interesting little poke from Richard asking Carrington, what's going on with the time capsule? So, Carrington, maybe you can tell us about that.
And very little. In fact, if people are interested, you should be hanging out in the Vintage Computer forums.
Oh, right. You're talking
somebody
about
asked
there.
About there, and I sort of did an update there. So, listeners, come on. Hang out in the forums with us. Ask questions. It's fun there. Really,
if I might, Carrington, I would like to ask everyone to start sending Carrington unique and different screwdrivers.
For me to hack into this thing. Yeah, but in short, basically it's still a holding pattern. I have gone back twice to the the Xerox Tower building that's in, spoken to various people in management, and got one person, I think I was mentioning last show, that walked down and saw it and admitted to me that, yes, there it is. And there's a plaque saying it should have been open months ago now. But still nothing has come. And I keep my eye on it. I'm still trying to convince somebody to open this stupid thing up. I can't get anybody to actually – everyone seems to think it's somebody else's problem. So I can't get at my stuff, and I can't convince them to open this stupid time capsule. Anybody else in Toronto can just still swing by and look at it. So just right up there, Yonge and Finch.
You know, in all seriousness, I wonder who owns it. I guess the Xerox owns it. No, the time capsule itself, I guess it's on Xerox property, so they own it.
Yeah, so, I guess so.
So, you know, if you busted it open or whatever, they'd have to press charges to you.
But at least then that would bring it to the news. And then they'd have a big opening ceremony, and I'd be in jail, and I'll miss it. So that's a bad plan.
Only if they press charges?
They will. I'm a very, very disreputable fellow. One look at me, you know, like, that's it. Check them in the who's gow. So, David, tell me, vintage computer shows.
Yeah, so basically just, you know, want to get the mentions in here, you know, the next couple of shows. So don't forget the Vintage Computer Festival East 8.0 is happening the weekend of May 5th and 6th at the InfoAge Science Center in Wall, New Jersey. So link in the show notes or do a search for Vintage Computer Festival East. And, I'll just mention it. But great show. Looks like it's going to be the biggest one they've had yet. A lot of great special speakers and stuff. Oh, yeah, you're going?
I'm definitely going, yeah. I mean, unless something came up, but my plan is to go. It's on my calendar. So.
That's right.
And it's in driving distance, really, of Toronto, so I'm just going to make a trip of it for the weekend.
And then next, of course, Kansas Fest, which the three of us have confirmed and committed to going, and that happens in July. It starts on it's a Wednesday, isn't it? July 17th? Starts on a Wednesday?
Yeah, Wednesday to Sunday. But the main meat of it goes the Thursday to the Saturday. So.
Okay, so July 17th to 22nd. And a Kansas Fest 2012, which, you know, I was trying to tell someone this at the this is the 23rd. Okay, this is the 23rd annual convention. So I guess I was close. I said 20.
So we have had more podcast episodes than they have had events.
Yeah, but that's 23 years of it.
Well, they should do it more frequently.
Did they ever
do
miss
it every
a year?
3 weeks like us? You know, I have no idea. The people that ask about that would be the Kansas Fest committee.
Yeah.
We could have them on and interview them, berate them, see what they know about Major Tom.
So anyway, that's it. That's it for that. I want to bring that up.
Cool.
No other big shows I know of offhand.
Yeah, and there's actually another one that I'm glad you reminded me about the listener feedback, because we also got some information about Chicago Cocoa Fest.
Oh, right. Oh, we forgot to put it in there. Okay.
And there will be, but we'll get it in there. It'll be in the show notes.
Okay.
It's called the 21st Last Chicago Cocoa Fest. They always call each one the last one because they honestly don't know from year to year if it's going to be the last one or not. So they're just hedging their bet.
I love that they always call it the last one.
It's kind of, that's very amusing. Mm-hmm. It's Saturday, May 19th, and Sunday, May 20th. And Saturday is 10 to 5, Sunday is 10 to 3 p.m. It's at the Holiday Inn Hotel and Suites in Elgin, Illinois. And we will have links for this and for the Glenside Color Computer Club Incorporated that has some of the information for this particular show.
Yeah,
but
I
did
have
want
those.
To get that out there. If you're a cocoa fanatic, you know, it may be the last one, so you better get to this show. And I think they've also got YouTube videos with more information, maybe some excerpts from previous shows. I haven't actually checked those out. But again, the link will be up there. So if you're a color computer fanatic, then you want to check this out.
Well, you know, and last year it was at the same time as the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest. And I think he says it in his email here. So I wonder if that's going on at the same time. Well, anyway, we'll put links up.
Mm-hmm. I used to have a Cocoa when I was young. I didn't really use it that much. It was one of those Chiclet keyboard ones. I wasn't as big into it, but I liked it. It was, you know, cartridge based, and I had a little driving game thing, sort of top down maze driving game that I really really liked. But it used the world's worst joysticks, these little Radio Shack joysticks, little black boxes with a thin upright metal stick that was completely loose. Like there was no feedback to it, so it was just you'd wobble around like tactilely, however you pronounce it, really, really not a pleasurable joystick to use, like the worst joystick in the history of everything. But I had that Cocoa for years and years and years and did some little programming on it. And I used to use it sort of as a dedicated CompuServe access machine for a while. So it was hooked up to a little acoustic coupler modem. So what about you guys? Either of you ever have a Cocoa?
I never had one.
Not originally, I didn't. But I've had a couple over the years. And I have a Dragon now.
I do have a microcolor computer, the Tandy MC10. It's a little teeny tiny Cocoa.
Nice.
With a small amount of RAM. And again, one of those, you know,
tiny. As opposed to the huge amount of RAM in the regular Cocoa?
But
vast amount of RAM.
Even less. But, you know, one of the things I always liked about the Radio Shack machines, they have a great BASIC. They really do. By comparison to some of the other 8-bit machines, the BASIC language, even on the Cocos, mm-hmm. was awesome. And it's interesting because there's an entire niche community of interest with the Radio Shack color computers. There's a whole nother one. They call themselves the 99ers, you know, the TI-99
right.
enthusiasts. Neither of those communities have I had a lot of interaction with, but I know there's stuff going on, you know, same kind of stuff as the computers that we tend to use more, like the Commodore or Apple, modern-day add-ons and things like this Cocoa Fest. It's just a little bit less conspicuous to me because I haven't really been in those worlds, but there's definitely enthusiast groups out there for those systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So write us. Let us know you're out there. You know, we'll talk about them just like this.
Totally, yeah. I'm pretty sure my Cocoa had 16K. Maybe. It would have been. I think they came in 4, 16, and 32 versions, and I don't think it would have been 4. I did a bunch of basic programming on it. I think it was 16K, though. It was a Cocoa 1. I had one of the original ones, which I think was – that's 1980 to 1983 range. Those were out, if memory serves. Something like that. Very early 80s, I think it was. It was the first of the –
1980
the
color computer one. Oh, yeah, it came with 16Ks. Oh, no, there was a 4K. I can imagine 1980, a 4K.
Yeah. So I'm not really sure. I'm pretty sure mine was probably the 32.
Yeah, it's 4, 16, or 32.
Yeah, so it wouldn't have been a super tricked out one. It was a gift from my parents, actually. I was super, super into computers by this time. So it was probably a birthday or a Christmas gift or something. So my parents very nicely spoiled the heck out of young Carrington. But I did a ton. There was because the BASIC that came with it, Earl's completely right. It was a nice BASIC, but it was like a color BASIC, and you could do a lot with it. And so I did a bunch of BASIC stuff, and then eventually it just became my dedicated CompuServe machine because mm-hmm. It was the time of CompuServe.
And I think so. It started off silver, then it went to beige,
mm-hmm.
and in the picture here, it looks like the European one is white even. But I think finally at one point they dropped the whole TRS-80 out of the name too.
Oh yeah,
called it the color computer. I think
it wasn't. It wasn't a great. It was a chiclet sort of keyboard, and it was not awesome to type on. And I had a printer. I had the world's most useless printer. Came with it. It was essentially like a cash register printer. So it was a printer, but it must have been like a 2 or 3 inch wide piece strip of paper would come out of it.
Yeah.
And it worked with pens. It had these little color pens.
Oh yeah.
And they would. Basically, it's drawings.
So I've seen that.
And we go down and just like unbelievably inefficient. Imagine like here as a handing in an essay. Here you go, professor. Here's my,
but those
my
things are fun to watch, though. I know the things you're talking about, and they're really fun to look at.
But as a kid, like I needed it for schoolwork. So this wasn't
That's not as much fun then. Didn't the Cocoa 3 have a better keyboard? We're kind of going on a tangent here, but I thought the Cocoa 3 had a more full stroke.
It does. It did.
From the looks of it, it did. But I've never had been hands-on with a Cocoa 2 or a Cocoa 3. I've only ever had my original Cocoa 1.
Yeah, I'm looking at a Wikipedia thing here. Yeah, the first one, it wasn't really chiclet. It was
Yeah, it wasn't chiclet, but they were very, very – like these little square things, and they would barely depress at all.
Right,
so there wasn't a lot of action to
sort of
keyboard.
A hybrid mm-hmm, chiclet mm-hmm. to a regular keyboard or whatever.
And the case, if you guys have touched them, you would know, but if you just see photos of them, it looks like almost like aluminum. I'm looking at them now, photos on the net, and it's like – it looks – but it's not. It's a very, very light plastic.
Right.
So like it doesn't feel the way it would look from photographs.
Mm-hmm. It's the same material as the TR-80s. It's the same sort of like silver,
right.
A matte silver painted plastic.
Mm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a Model 1 and a Model 4 as well. So I've actually, strangely, had a lot of TRS-80 stuff, even though I've always considered myself an Apple guy.
Yeah, and I have a Model 1, and in fact, and I've showed it off a few times and done talks and everything, and unfortunately, there's kind of like a seam around the middle. There's like a scap or whatever. But part, like, it's snapped off at a couple of, like, the plastic has gotten very brittle.
There was a discussion on, to bring it back down to the forum, there was a discussion I was sort of following but not contributing in that with somebody specifically talking about that, the difficulty of finding Model 1s in decent condition. See, again, lots of interesting stuff on that forum. Everyone should scurry over there. I'm digging it. Okay, so let's move on. So we've got, what's up next? Oh, you know what? up next is the another thing about Google Maps, or rather, we were talking earlier about the online Mozilla thing, the browser quest, but totally separate from that, Google Maps has a new feature. And I just sort of stumbled on this, and I don't know when this got launched, but when you're looking at Google Maps, you just go over to maps.google.com, you'll see there's a quest option now. You always be able to look at, you know, satellite and traffic and Earth. You can now pick quest, and your map is all done in 8-bit style. I'm like, why is this happening? Have you guys noticed this?
No.
Yeah, so head over to just maps.google.com or like maps.google.co.uk or whatever, and over you can hover over the map and you'll see there's quest is one of your options. And now and if you look for directions, it'll show like a little 8-bit guy. It's in the format of like you're looking at an NES game, and the guy will walk and avoid the little 8-bit mountains.
Oh yeah, that's wild.
Totally, oh my gosh, this is so hilarious.
View 8-bit landmarks, be a hero, explore the world, find hidden monsters. That is I wonder why they decided to start doing that.
I don't know, but they even have, if you go on YouTube, you can see they've put out a joke video about how this is really the beta test for a new 8-bit NES cartridge they're coming out with. So you can get Google Maps on your NES. And it's got a
My
little,
Neighborhood in Super Mario.
Totally. And it's got a little plug-in for, supposedly on the cartridge, you can plug it into your modem. You style up. And it says, in the instructions, it says, you know, turn it on, then try to search, then pull the cartridge out and blow into it, and then put it back in, then turn
it. Does it really go that far down where it makes your neighborhood look like it?
No,
okay.
Not so much.
Oh,
but no, it's really just the one map, but you can zoom in to see like major highways as 8-bit paths. But the fun thing is to look search for a place and go from, like in my case, I might put Toronto and go directions and say I want to go from Toronto to Chicago. And then it shows the directions in like zoomed in. Here's your 8-bit path on how to get one place to another. So
I think it's so cool.
Yeah, so did you guys, I sort of stumbled on, I saw this quest button, I clicked on it, I'm like, well, what the heck is this?
No idea what this is about, but this is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, as you zoom in, I mean, it still looks Mario-like, and it's got some landmarks that are labeled, but no drawings.
But it's honestly, it's just like suddenly Google Maps has become a Zelda thing, so it's just like a map out of Zelda. It's totally
neat. Awesome. Yeah.
So it's just 8-bit, like it's that whole retro 8-bit sort of style that's gotten so huge. And while, you know, we're on here because we love the vintage tech and vintage computers, it's also there's the whole vintage fashion in a sense. And I think this is part of that. It's just 8-bit and 80s stuff is just huge at the moment. And and here's another example of that out in the real world.
So you're saying they're finally catching up to us.
Finally, exactly. So, Earl, well, I just searched 8-bit stuff to go from Toronto to Chicago, and I'm living here in Toronto. It seems the next bit of news is from Toronto, but you spotted it instead of me.
Well, you are one of the focal points in Toronto for the Commonwealth. I know that just breaks you all up, Carrington.
Absolutely.
Nevertheless, it's true. Between the Toronto Pet Users Group, or
T-Pug,
and the World of Commodore show that happens there, I believe coordinated and sponsored by T-Pug, and now they've got their own YouTube channel, the Toronto Pet Users Group YouTube channel, which you should go over to because you can see video of past World of Commodore shows and other things that they've got posted up there. And I just saw this recently on the Commodore News page, one of the blogs that I follow. So I'm expecting there will be more videos up over there as time goes on. And some of the ones that I looked at were fun. And, of course, if you couldn't go to the World of Commodore, which I've never been to one of those shows, then this is a way to look back at some of the fun they had. So check it out.
Crazy that I got to go all the way to Kansas to have an 8-bit show.
The Apple IIc, you should switch sides.
Right here locally.
It's right there. It would be like, you know, having an Apple show in Portland.
Mm-hmm. So, alas. But it's pretty cool that they have their own channel. It's really well done. And once I saw the link, I popped over and looked at a bunch of things. So that's really cool. But yeah, T-Pug, I think I mentioned in an earlier episode, like ages ago, that I had a very good friend, Derek, in high school. And his father, I think, was one of the founding members of T-Pug or whatever that. And like, so he knew about it. So I sort of always heard all about T-Pug, like all the time through David or through I've looked at the word David, so suddenly I'm
like,
so I was like, how'd that happen? So I used to hear about it all the time, but I've never, you know, attended because I was never really into the Commodore world.
Well, I mean, your loss, but you should
Commodore's gain.
You should consider it. at some point.
Never. So instead, we will move on. David, talk to me about more Canadian things, including TVO, TV Ontario. We talked about TV Ontario last episode, where I was mentioning the big influence on my life that has been the kids show called Read All About It.
I'm
building hosts for my new video podcast that are based on the computers and Read All About It. And now you've got something you want to talk about.
That they have put this up on the web for people to watch. Yeah, so there's a show that came out of Canadian educational television, TV Ontario, TVO, and it's called Bits and Bytes. And I'll tell a quick story. I don't think I've told it before, maybe, but my introduction to Bits and Bytes, never saw it originally, but I joined the U.S. Army in 1990, and I went off the basic training at Fort Dix, New Jersey, and I graduated out of there in January, I don't know, sometime late January. Actually, this isn't the stuff I was going to talk about. Anyway, so then I went to my what's called your base, you know, your AITs, where you learn how to do your job. You know, so I was there for 6 months in Augusta, Georgia, at Fort Gordon. All right, so I graduated basic training. I get to Fort Gordon. You still have a drill sergeant when you get to this other. You're not like a full fledged soldier yet, but it's not as hardcore as what basic training is. But during your first few weeks there, you're called on phase, and what that means is you do your training during the day or whatever. But when you're off duty, you still have to wear your uniform and you can't leave the base until you become off phase. And to get off phase, you have to earn it by doing different things. So one of the requirements was to visit their educational center, and you had to check out some different learning videos, different things, and meet some requirements. So I did that, and it turned out that one of the things was technology, and it turned out they had this show on I don't even know, it must have been on VHS. I'm pretty certain it had to be on VHS tape because it's 1991. So I found this show, and this is early in my becoming interested in computer history, and I just ate this show up. So it was already, you know, it was like 8 years old, which is getting very outdated, right, in computer technology. So for me, it was like a retro computing fest of watching the show, because it's all based in around 1982, and they talk about all the different personal computers and learning the fundamentals behind it and programming and what you can do with them and software and so on. It's just a fantastic television show. There's a lot of great cartoons in it which describe some basic functionality of computers. So it just became a favorite of mine. And so to end that story, and I met my wife there too around that same time. And so believe it or not, when I started dating my wife, I brought her back to the entertainment center, and showed her this, which she thought it was cute. She wasn't like, why are you showing me this?
She married you anyway. That's awesome.
I watched it again, the whole thing.
I was like, well,
I didn't have to, but I watched it again. Huh?
I think there was only something like, you know, 10 or 12, 12 episodes, starred Luba Goy and Billy Van, two very famous sort of Canadian...
Who I didn't learn who they were until much later on.
Yeah, and they were both, you know, famously in a lot of Canadian things and on Canadian television and that kind of stuff, and did comedy things. And Billy Van in particular with Hilarious House of Frightenstein and stuff, and just sort of very famous Canadian
people.
That is
a weird show.
It's a totally weird show. But Bits and Bytes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I watched it when it was new, when it came out, and so from 83 or whatever, and just watched it then. And
here we are now. It's almost a 30-year-old show, and it's just a fantastic time capsule of personal.
It's too bad not all. They only put up 4 of the episodes on the TV site.
Oh, is it really just the 4?
I know, and I'm like, come on, just put up all 12.
Well,
so annoying.
One of my to-do list things is I have all of them. And they're decent quality copies that I got from another fan, and it took me a long time to track down someone that had them all, and then to, you know, have somebody make me copies of them.
Well, that's a general problem with TVO stuff. There's a lot of TVO made a lot of great educational programming. It was like sort of the Ontario version of. It's public broadcasting for Ontario, and so it was very much supported by the Ontario government and taxes, and it got a lot of discounts and limited use things. So all the time these shows would license in a very temporary way graphics and music and that kind of stuff, but then they were never able to renew them. Like, you can't TVO can't put out this stuff on DVD because it would be too expensive to go and track down the rights holders and repay for all the music and stuff. So all this stuff got made, but very short-sightedly got licensed in a way that it got to run on broadcast television and can't be distributed in any other way. That's why so much of their stuff isn't on the TVO website and why you can't go and buy DVDs of a lot of the children's shows I loved as a kid.
Yeah, that stinks.
Because unfortunately, it's completely crazy. So instead, you just have to go find pirated versions of it all, and it's really too bad that because of licensing, you just can't get it.
Bite the inside of my cheek so that I won't go off on a copyright rant, but I do have a question for you, though, Carrington. Do you think that's the reason why there's only four of these episodes?
Almost certainly, yes. I bet you the other episodes all use something that they licensed and they can't put out there. I bet you there's some bit of music or a bit of graphics or one of those computer-generated things or something. Because all the times, if you watch a TVO show, always at the end it'll say it was made with the assistance of like Apple Computer and this composer and all that. Because basically everybody donated this stuff, but the license agreement would be for broadcast television. And so that's it. They can't put a lot of them on the net. They can't sell them. They can't – nothing. It's really disappointing.
So, I mean, but if there was a chance it wasn't like that, I think if you wrote to – TV Ontario and said, hey, could you put more up there? Maybe they'd at least respond to you. I mean, you being an Ontario-Iranian, would probably have more pull.
Yeah, and that's what we call ourselves, Ontario-Iranians. I wrote to TV Ontario years ago looking for a couple of shows, basically saying, you know, I want a copy, read all about it, and essentially I'm willing to mortgage things to get it. And producer really nicely wrote back to me and said, you know, for exactly this reason, the music and a lot of things in, we hired people and got rights for just broadcast television, and there's just nobody around who could even start to negotiate new rights, and it would be really expensive, and just we're a government-run thing, and there's just not the money. So that stuff it's all on tape, and it's stuck in an archive, and will never be released. And we've lost the right to broadcast it on TV anymore. So we have the right to keep the tapes, but not to distribute it in any other way. So they just, we have it. We have it and you can't.
I'm going to mute myself while I bang my head on the desk here.
Very nicely, though. I should mention
I forgot to mute myself.
A gal named Suzanne, who's a local gal here in Canada, fan of 1 MHz and also a fan listener to our episodes, very nicely dropped off at my place because I'm pretty easy to find. I came home about a week and a half ago and had dropped off a DVD burned copy of all the really nice VHS quality copies of all the episodes of Read All About It, which turns out are on the net. I just couldn't find them, and she has better Google Foo than me, so she grabbed them, downloaded them all, and stuck them on a couple of DVDs for me. So I wrote her back, and it was just like crazy awesome. I'm so happy. So I've been slowly going through them. Just a crazy good gift, like just – the nicest thing a listener has ever done. Mm. We have awesome listeners.
So hopefully we'll see more of them. But this show, and then as a piece, as a time capsule and computer history related, is one of my all-time favorites, along with The Machine That Changed the World, you know, the PBS documentary.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome.
Which is almost 20 years ago. Well, it is 20 years ago. So
nice. So hooray for public television. And you know, we were talking recently about the retro stuff like that, with the Google Maps going all 8-bit and the retro fashion and retro stuff like that. If you're interested in modern retro games and retro design, Penny Arcade has a very nice article up on their Penny Arcade Report site, where it's called The Art of Modern Retro, How Indies Can Create Wonderful Pixel Art. So if you're interested in the sort of the details of pixel art, how to make games that have that 8-bit feel, and why you'd want to do it right approaches and sort of maybe you could consider wrong approaches, like doing something at a higher resolution than dithering it down, and why that doesn't look as good as something designed from, you know, with the 8-bit sensibility from the ground up, and how to do the design and pros and cons of different approaches and all that kind of stuff. There's tons of info there. So if you're interested in game design, if you're interested in making your own games, if you're interested in the 8-bit feel of things, this is a really well thought out and very detailed article. Over on Penny Arcade. A couple of guys wrote it, Robert Boyd and William Strindberg, I guess that would be pronounced, Strindberg? Robert and William, we'll call them. But I really liked it, and I learned a lot from it, things I wouldn't have thought of. I'm not really interested in making a game, but I'm interested in the ideas. And they don't talk about just 8-bit stuff, but sort of retro things in general and shaders and all that kind of stuff. So it's really, really interesting. And they talk about why they made certain choices when it came to the Penny Arcade games, and they talk about the pros and cons of different design choices when it comes to 8-bit artwork, especially when it deals with motion graphics and games and that kind of stuff. A lot of stuff there that I hadn't seen elsewhere. So it's really, really well thought out material. So if you're interested in this stuff, I would definitely suggest head over to the rcr.com and look at the show notes and get that link, because it's really a really good article.
I could definitely see where just trying to take something at modern resolutions and down-resing it would not have nearly the artistic impact. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be like when they try and take something that they made in modern-day film and graining it up so that it looks old. But you know, it never really looks old, right?
Yeah, it just looks blurry if you do it that way.
Either blurry or it looks like you intentionally introduce some noise, or so, but they can never get that old film feel. It seems like that'd be along the same lines. That's fascinating. I'll have to read that too.
Yeah, it's really good. And it's long, but you know, it's an article, so you can plug through it. Read it right after you read David's article.
I haven't heard of this website before. That's pretty cool.
You never heard of Penny Arcade?
No. What? Well, I mean, I've heard of the Penny Arcade, just not this website.
Oh, well, this is it's just on penny-arcade.com, so it's on Penny Arcade, and they do a thing called the Penny Arcade Report.
And so it's mostly about, like, I guess more traditional arcade-style gaming and such, right?
Well, yeah, and just about, like, really, they talk about lots of different stuff. It's not normally, like, a retro thing, but they had recently they had a really good article about pinball stuff, and just, you know, just gaming in general and stuff that would be of interest to people who are interested in Penny Arcade. Penny Arcade Report's really, really an interesting thing, and it just, you know, game-oriented, obviously.
I love this. I went to the About, right? And this is what it says, the Penny Arcade Report. And then it says, quote-unquote, games journalism is broken. Many sites suffer from forced output cycles, quote-unquote, news about cakes, and playing along with the industry PR machine. We can do better. I like that.
Right.
I'm finding out something about that myself.
So next up, we have something. Switch away from the sort of the popular culture of 8-bit style and fashion into something more academic. So there was recently something published by three fellows. I think they're Belgian academics.
Yeah.
It was published through Cornell, but I think two of them are from the Open Belgium University and one's from MIT. But they went to prove, like basically to prove in a formal way, that the relative difficulty of vintage games. So they looked at five Nintendo games. There was Donkey Kong, Mario, Legends of Zelda, Metroid, and what was the other one? I think Pokemon.
Yeah,
Pokemon. And then they studied them. I mean, most of it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, but it is a formal essay, and they look in a formal way where they try to measure and essentially prove the difficulty level of classic Nintendo games, and they come to the conclusion that they are NP hard. They are as hard as they get.
Yeah, what does that mean, NP?
Versus the formal level of you know, like, have you done, I don't know, how am I going to describe this to you? Like, it's versus, like, first you're looking at whether something is NP complete, like whether you can actually do it or not. And so what they're doing here is just sort of formally measuring the difficulty level of these. And the way they did it was to say, like, can things be completed from certain points in the game? And so they're sort of looking at it that way. But they go in real detail about looking at things like poker. It's weird to read in an academic setting, like these really well-researched, very, very thoughtful look at, can you complete a Pokemon game from this position and stuff like, so just really, really interestingly applying game theory and that kind of stuff. So if you're interested in game theory versus game design, last article, great for people interested in game design and the graphics end. If you're interested in game theory and provability and difficulty levels and that kind of stuff in a very formal way, that this Cornell University article or publication rather is really interesting, and it's completely available for free online. A lot of stuff like this is harder to get a hold of in its real format, but there's a PDF that you can get. We'll have a link in the show notes to that, and you can read it. It came out just earlier this month, and I read it, and it's awesome, and it's you know, got some humor to it, but it really is a formal academic paper on this, and it's really, really thoughtful, and has some really great ideas in it. So,
and you've inspired me, Carrington. I mean, at least the degree that I have posted on the wall, and I think I got it at some point in the past, says computer science on it, and doggone it, if I could. I just never could get the mathematical concept of NP complete and NP hard. It's just, right. For some reason, it just bounces off my skull as if, you know, I read it and I never read it, you know, kind of thing. So I'm going to go understand it. I swear to you, I'm going to figure out what that means.
P equals MP, not equals MP.
Exactly. So that then I can be impressed by the fact that these old retro games are NP hard. Because right now it's kind of like saying they're yellow like butter, you know. And I'm right. I don't understand what that means. So
I always found both the math and more the logic of decision problems in this kind of idea, the NP sets and stuff like that, and the subsets of NP when you're looking at NP complete and stuff. Really interesting things. I find it fascinating that somebody can apply this kind of stuff. Obviously, it can be applied to anything, but I love the idea of mixing just retro Nintendo games with a formal Cornell publication. So just really interesting to read. And it's neat how the approach and the tone is so much different than that Penny Arcade one. But I think there could be a lot of overlap in the audiences that these appeal to. So I just wanted to sort of bring them both up. And the last thing I wanted to bring up really briefly was AtariMagazines.com, Kevin Savitz's site, has put – boy, this is like an all-Canadian show. So he has put up all 10 of the old Canadian Atari magazine called ROM. So if you're interested in Atari stuff, and I might have an Atari choice for my eBay auction later on in the episode, hint, hint. So it was a short-lived magazine. I'd never heard of it before, but it was a Canadian one. And ran from 1983 to, I think, just the beginning of 1985. And all 10 issues, which I believe is the complete set, are available on AtariMagazines.com, which is such a good site. Like, I mean, it's a very simple site, but if you're looking for content, it's awesome.
It really is.
I love what he's doing. And I love the fact that someone's doing it, because not a lot of people would step up and actually get this content available. So the fact that he does it is amazing. And I like the format, too, because you get the pictures, but you also get his text. But they're I don't know if he's scanning it or typing out the text or whatever, but I love the way they does it, because it's so much more – it might not look as pretty as just scans of magazine pages, but it's so much more searchable and makes it so much more available on the net, I think. So I like this approach a lot that he takes. And there's a review of Wizard of War, one of my all-time favorite games in the arcade, in the first episode – or the first issue. So I read that. So I just want to point people – for fans of Atari should scurry over to that and look at it.
Aren't you astronauts?
Buzz Aldrin.
Gordon Cooper.
Scott Carpenter.
We like to compare notes with Stevie on the new space station.
Hello?
Hi, Tommy Lasorda for Stevie.
Hey, what's up?
Just a question about moving Randolph to the number 2 position.
Yeah, second, and this'll work. It's perfect.
Hi.
Hey.
We're the Pointer Sisters.
Stevie's expecting us.
Well, come in.
We need help with our new album.
Bert Bacharach. Little Richard.
The Amiga. Color, sound, graphics, power. At a price to make it truly the computer for the creative mind.
Can you hear me, Steve?
What can the Amiga do? Well, what do you want it to do?
Mr. O'Neill! Stevie is upstairs, but it's kind of crowded. Would you like some fried chicken while you're waiting?
Can you hear me? Amiga from Commodore. The computer for the creative mind.
Computerland's business whiz is for
small business.
It'll even do my accounting.
Big business.
We can network.
Even mom, pop.
It's easy.
And kid business.
Wow.
Save on your answer. The Compact Portable 2, the answer for portability. Improved design and technology make it 30% smaller and 400% faster than the original Compact. Compact Portable 2, setting a new standard in portability.
When you need answers now, it's Computerland.
Why don't we turn our attention to gifts? Gifts that we can buy me, or other people that may be interested in retro computing. David,
gifts you always want. You always want iTunes.
I do. I know I'm going to want something.
Well, I mean, come
week.
On. You had such a great pick this time.
Well, since I was scurrying around trying to find a good gift idea, and I was sort of failing at first, I went the cheater route and thought, oh, I know, Star Trek. So I did a search at ThinkGeek for Star Trek, and in fact, there's a link in the show notes to, you know, everything Star Trek at ThinkGeek, and there's a lot of other. There's like a plush Star Trek Enterprise, awesome, right? Not necessarily retro computing related, nor is what I chose, the Star Trek electronic door chime, but just very cool. And you know, this one looks like those wall communicator devices that they had on the original Enterprise. Because unlike the next generation, they didn't walk around with the, you know, their badges were communicators. So you go to the nearest one and hail, I guess, the bridge or whatever. So yeah, it's just pretty cool.
It's totally awesome. So,
like, and there's something about Star Trek that goes with, I don't know, especially retro computing. There's always been a connection. I wrote about that in my very first issue of Historically Brewed.
Well, one of those first games that they had on the mainframes was a Star Trek, a character-based Star Trek game, right? Where you were wandering around through quadrants and trying to blast the Klingons.
Right, right. That was the first thing I ever played on a computer.
It is a natural association.
It's totally
better or for worse.
And it's a great pick, and it's only $30. Available now from ThinkGeek. Star Trek electronic door chime with motion sensor door chime. It's, I want it very badly.
Yeah, check out the other stuff. And if you look at the picture for the door chime, the guy in the picture is like looking over at it, and he's got a robe, a Star Trek robe.
No, I want to live his lifestyle.
Made to be like a, you know, a Star Trek shirt, classic Star Trek shirt.
Yep. Totally awesome. Totally awesome.
A friend of mine had a dream that he said if he became a millionaire, his living room would be decked out like the bridge of the Enterprise.
Of the original one?
I too want to be single forever. But
that
would be pretty awesome.
If you found the right girl. My wife, for instance, loves Star Trek. So.
Actually, yes, that's how I would know I found the right girl. She shows up and she's willing to come back, and when she sees my living room, it's the Enterprise Bridge, because I would love my living room to be.
And you
could
buy that chair. I mean, I haven't looked at this recently, but off the top of my head, I think it's $2,000. But it's like
a
totally authentic, you know, looks exactly like the real chair with a platform and everything.
That's an expensive chair, though. Holy cow.
Yeah.
So what about you, Earl? What would you recommend the gift buyer get a retro computer lover?
Well, boy, on this show, I'm just 24/7 Commodore heaven. But I've got another Commodore item up here called the Easy Flash 3 cartridge.
What's
and if you're
that?
A Commodore 64 lover, this is the cartridge to end all cartridges. Because it doesn't just do what a lot of these flash cartridges do for modern computers, like there's one for Atari and that kind of thing that'll let you bring up a menu and pick from a variety of things that's on the cartridge. It does that. It definitely does that. But it also has a feature to allow you to dynamically replace the kernel portion of the ROM that's running in your Commodore. So if you want to swap in another kernel, let's say that you're a Commodore kernel hacker and you want to go in there and play around and change out pieces of the kernel to do other things, you want to do that kind of low-level stuff, you can do that as well with this cartridge and more. So I won't give everything away. People should go take a look at it if you're a Commodore enthusiast. I think this is one of the things you're definitely going to want in your toolkit. Seems like with an enclosure, I remember the price being $65. And so that's not too terribly bad. I think that's a few bucks more than the original Easy Flash was. But, man, this thing can do a lot of stuff. So
very
that's
cool.
My pick.
Nice. Well, I say nice, but really I think, Commodore, whatever. But I'm trying to be a good host, so I'll say, oh, nice choice.
Okay. Good job, Kieran.
Nice choice. My choice is a little bit broader than I've been going in the last few episodes. I am going to suggest that if you've got someone in your life who is a vintage fan, a fan of vintage tech in any sort of way, and you're stuck with an idea, what can I get this person? Well, if one nice and relatively inexpensive, or at least a range of things you can get them, is a vintage calculator. Most people in their offices have a calculator, some little thing from Staples. It's boring, it's bland, it's whatever. Any lover of vintage tech will very happily instead use like a cool vintage TI calculator or something from Commodore, something like that, something that's got little, that vintage sort of glowing LED, something that's got little red flickery bits. It looks like a Mattel game. I would much rather have something like that in my office than your modern $10 calculator. And they can be readily had. Yes, there's sometimes vintage calculators because they're very collectible. It can be hundreds and hundreds of dollars. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about just a simple little stocking stuffer type thing. You can easily go on eBay. We'll have a link in the show notes just to search vintage computer section for calculators. But there's lots of other places on eBay where you can find perfect condition working vintage calculators, usually in the box, that are just something that's got that 60s or 70s or 80s feel to it. And if you're just looking for a calculator at your office, that's going to be just as good as anything you pick up for $10 at Staples, but will be so much more interesting and so much more fun, and probably have to run off a 9-volt battery though. So it's one of those things where I know I personally would have preferred something like that to what I'm using at work, and I think the vintage tech lovers in your life would probably like something like that too. So that's my suggestion. Screw over to eBay and get yourself a cool vintage calculator to give your vintage tech lover today. Do it.
Yeah, what are some of those older mechanical calculator devices called? Like, what's the one where it's like a sort of looks like a pepper grinder? It has like the little dial on the top.
You guys well, those things are from. Yeah,
you yeah, this is like 100 years old.
you're not gonna pick up one of those. Jeez. there's lots of stuff like that, like various counting and reckoning tools. I think there's that book. There's currently a book on eBay, called Calculated Chronicle 300, Calculated Chronicle 300 Years of Counting or something like that.
I reckon.
So if you want to learn about those things, but that would be more for somebody really into calculators. I'm looking for something I think that just somebody who digs vintage computers and likes the style of it would probably dig having a 1983 look at TI.
Yeah, that's a Curta. I'm thinking of mechanical calculator. Here's one for $1,500. And here's one for $2,200, one for $3,000.
That's not my suggestion. I'm not
suggesting. The old adding machines, though, were cool, weren't they? Chung, chung, chung,
chung, chung, chung, chung, chung. Something like that, too.
Great.
But I'm thinking something you can throw in, you pick up for $15 and someone could throw in their desk. This is my suggestion.
Something you could really use.
Yeah, actually, Carrington, on your search, if you go up to, switch it to buy it now.
Right.
And then, look at shipping lowest first or whatever. Right. There's a vintage mid 1970s Commodore calculator. Buy it now, $1,485, free shipping.
See, that's the kind of thing. And wouldn't that be much
that's
more
pretty,
fun?
Yeah, that's pretty good because anything Commodore calculator.
Does it have the chicken head?
Yes.
Whoa!
Earl's about to go buy himself a calculator.
Yeah, take a look at it.
For a
made in England.
Commodore calculator.
Yeah, that's cheap.
It is
free. Look, it's in Lebanon, Oregon.
No way! It's even local. Oh, yeah. Shoot me this link. Link, link, link. And don't talk about this on the show. Edit this part out.
It'll be 1970s Commodore.
You better buy it now.
First electronic one.
$15.
I don't see the chicken head on it though. The one I'm looking.
It's real small.
Oh, the one I'm looking at is $300. That's why.
Do you see it in the link? Or no, I put it in the show notes.
Oh, did you? Cool.
Chat thing.
Our listeners will be very disappointed to see that that will probably has been purchased by the time they have one.
I used to have one like that. I could have swore I still had it. I don't see why I'd gotten rid of it. Maybe it's in a box somewhere.
Yeah, 14. Look at that. That's wow, and that's working and everything with the chicken head. Earl, have you bought it now yet? It's $15,
I'm
and it's got 24 days left in this.
I'm gonna buy it.
Now, holy cow! Look at that.
I'm buying
it. Oh yeah. No, you're not.
Earl, you should be purchasing this.
Earl, no problem, man. Just $55, and
it's mine, right?
Oh, you know why I didn't see it? Because it's currently not available for shipping to Canada. Oh, internet. How mean you are to me. This guy doesn't know what he has. This could sell for way more. And it's perfectly working. That's a sweet-looking calculator. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about, though. You go online, you find something like that, and a vintage tech lover would love it. So
I got to find mine. I know I have one.
So, guys, let's talk about auctions. Let's look at the auction choices we made last episode. Mine, I believe, did not sell, if I recall. I had picked there were a few of them online, and they rarely pop up, but I think three of them popped up at the same time last time. It's a Smith Corona Messenger module. It's a thing that lets you hook up an 8-bit vintage computer, a Commodore or an Apple or that kind of thing, to a vintage Smith Corona Messenger typewriter. So your Daisy Wheel typewriter becomes your printer. It's just such a cool dual-use device then. There were a few of them online, and they don't often that come up. I searched for ages to find the one that I have. This one's $30, but with fairly expensive shipping. I had to buy it now, and it's still on there. It never sold. But I know there were two other ones online, and both of those sold. So I guess I just picked the wrong one of the three. So there is still that available if people are interested. I love mine. I think it's very cool. Earl, what had you picked?
Just line up demand for three.
Clearly not. I don't think a lot of people are looking to hook up vintage Smith & Corona typewriters to their Commodore computers, but I find it a really cool way to get a printer going. So, Earl, what had you picked last time?
I picked a Microsoft Mach 20 286 upgrade card for a PC XT. And it looks like it got relisted a couple of times, and it's back up again, so it hasn't sold yet. You can bid on it for $290, or you could buy it now for, what, $350, something like that?
Yeah, $350.
That's it. Yeah. And so, they're just relisting it again. I don't know. You'd have to be pretty hardcore, like we mentioned last time, to actually plunk down that amount of change. But it is going to be a rarity being new in box. So
right.
I guess we'll just, keep an eye.
The other two items the seller is selling.
Price were to come down, it would, I think, have a better chance of selling, but on the other hand, maybe you just keep it on eBay until somebody bites.
Yeah, they're all ending. So they also have a vintage Intel above board AT ISA memory expansion board, and then a Tecmar First Mate PC Mate ISA memory expansion board.
What I'd really love to find at some point is the inboard 386, the 386 upgrade for the PCXT. Now, those were cool.
So cool.
So what about you, David? What had you selected last time, why didn't it sell?
I didn't sell. I chose the Compact Portable 3 Model 2 2660 Vintage Collectible. Its collectible is right in the name there.
So that's how you
rare.
Know.
Rare.
Right.
Rare look with zeros.
So this is just a buy it now or make offer ongoing, so there's no time limit or whatever.
But this is, I think, the first time all three of us didn't get sales. Wow. All three of us picked clunkers.
That stinks.
Oh, well, it happens. So, yeah, that didn't sell either. It's still available for $185 if you want to get yourself a Model 3 portable. So maybe we can do better this time, guys. So let's pick new, hot eBay items that our listeners can rush out and plunk down their hard-earned money on. David, what will you suggest that people mortgage their houses for first?
Okay.
I just really like your pick, David. I love your pick, by the way. I saw that one myself.
I would buy this week's pick rather than your last one because what you're about to announce is totally awesome.
I chose, and it's not on eBay, it's at vintage-computer.com's marketplace, by the way, the Vintage Computer and Gaming Marketplace. So it's a Zorba personal computer, and it's got a very low starting bid, so $1 with no bids. Come on, it's in New Jersey. This is a... does it say it works? Unit powers up. The splash screen has severe jitter. Okay, so it needs some work.
Yeah, but it comes with a really cool case.
Yep, and I have one of these, by the way. So I have this same machine.
Really?
Seriously, does it work?
Yeah, it does. I've had it for... it's one of my favorites as far as a luggable CPM device. And I've had it for a good while. I think at least 10 or 15 years. And I got it at a ham fest. And the guy couldn't sell it. And basically ended up giving it to me.
Holy cow.
So I got it free.
Oh,
but
nice.
Yeah, it's just a really neat sort of, I guess you could call it a clone of...
K-Pro.
Yeah. Thank you.
So it's got that it's a suitcase style computer. Mm-hmm.
But it's in a plastic case, and it comes with a real nice slip case that goes over it. And so I decided I thought I'd give the Vintage Computer and Gaming Marketplace a shot. And then as soon as I saw this, I was like, this has got to be my pick. So, if you can get it for... I don't know. I think it'd still be worth $50 to $100, even if you don't know if you can definitely get it working or not.
But should Rundo Walk has only got, as of this recording, a little less than 4 days left.
Yeah, 3 days, 21 hours.
Currently only one bid, no bids, and starting of $1. So you might be able to pick this up very cheaply if you rush over right now.
Yeah,
we'll have a link in the show notes, obviously. Very cool choice, the Zorba personal computer.
They get it.
CPM computer. So, Earl, what about you? What have you got to match up against the Zorba?
Oh, I can't beat that. But I can mention that the Commodore 8-bits, again with the Commodore, that from the PET on up had an electrical port called the user port, very popular with electronics hobbyists or expansion makers because it was a very open sort of TTL voltage level port, parallel, 8-bits and a little bit of handshaking. Lots of people made various things for this and projects, do-it-yourself projects. So what I have for my eBay auction is this, and it's a new, actually, product, a relay cartridge. And you plug it into the user port of your Commodore, and then it's got these relay connections. You do the programming in the Commodore to turn these lines on and off on the user port, and it will click the relays on and off, which means you could then control things with the relays that take more voltage.
Oh, cool.
You can't drive much voltage through the user port, but if you use the user port to do these little micro relays, then you can obviously pull more current through that. So, do lights, do little electronics projects, that kind of thing. So now it says new. I read somewhere that some of these products that say buy Handic, Handic was a company that made these products back in the 80s, but I don't think this is actually buy Handic, or at least let me rephrase. I think there's a chance it's not. I think it's possibly a reproduction because there were some folks who were making reproductions of some of these old products. And in that sense, not as good for a collector because if you were looking for the original thing, then you're kind of not getting it. But if you're looking for it to play with it, then better, right? Because it's probably got newer components. it's right. more likely to work and not be dead on arrival. So mm-hmm. I believe because this doesn't have the enclosure is one of the clues, because I think the original ones by Handic actually had a cartridge enclosure around them, whereas this is kind of a bare board that connects up to the user port. Doesn't matter to me. I mean, this would be a lot of fun to turn things on and off and play around with your Commodore remote controlling stuff.
Very nice.
$36.
Awesome.
Or $40 for a buy it now.
That's very cool, actually. I am going to go totally different than usual and not pick Apple items because I want to buy them all myself. No, I'm kidding. I'm actually going to give a couple of Atari items. The first is the what's called a programmer combo. There's two of them available, and it's just a $40 buy it now. And so if you're interested in Atari 400 and 800 and basically basic programming, this is the programming combo. Had the basic cartridge, it had the reference manual for basic, a little basic teaching guide, and all that kind of stuff. So it was sort of the get you started as an Atari 800 or 400 basic programmer. And what I like about this is it's a complete system. It's in the box, but it's not sealed, so it's usable. So if you've got an Atari 400 or 800 and you wanted to do some programming, but were sort of brand new to vintage computer programming or didn't really know basic or what have you, this is a nice, you know, looks kind of collectible. The guy's got two of them, and they look in great shape. So you get the box, you get the whole stuff. It's all still the disc is still sealed up, and it's usable. So it's both. It would complete your Atari 800 or 400 system, and you get some nice thing in a box, and here's something vintage that goes with it. But it's also something usable, and I always prefer the usable stuff. So if you're interested in becoming an Atari 800 or 400 basic programmer and want to do it on real hardware, then this will get you going. It's everything you need to start doing basic programming. $40 buy it now, so I liked it. I don't think it's very rare, but I like the fact that it's nice and complete.
And if you don't have the basic cartridge for the Atari, then this would be the best way to get it all in that nice bundle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I've got the pieces that go in here, but I don't have that actual programmer bundle, and that would be pretty cool.
Yeah, and none of it's rare. Like, the basic cartridge is really easy to come by. Like, all these bits and bobs are out there, especially the basic cartridge. Like, there's as many of those as 400s left. But this is a nice, like, it, you know, sits on your shelf and it's all complete. So I think if you're interested in the collecting aspect as much as the using aspect, and it gets you the manual and it gets you the whole thing. And the guy's got two of them and only for $40. So mm-hmm. it seemed decent. The other one, what were you going to say, Earl?
I'm just amazed of the number of Atari items, and a lot of them either complete in box or sealed in box, that come from Venezuela. I don't even know if it's the same seller either. I think somehow there's a hidden mine in Venezuela where, you know, deep underground are buried tons of this Atari stuff. Because
no, it's the same seller. It's this 80s Vault guy. I have actually bought a few things from him. And 80s Vault or them or whatever, but for some reason Venezuela has 800 million copies still sealed of every game ever made for the Apple II, at least ones from certain publishers. So
really?
Every single month, if you're interested in sealed brand new inbox games from I can't remember, there's a couple of publishers in particular, and every single month they list multiple copies of every single game and have been doing so for ages. I don't understand where they're all coming from and why this one seller has 9 million copies, but they seem to have everything ever put out by Epix, and just crazy numbers of the same games. Ship them, and actually brand new, and there's microcomputer games. That was the Avalon Hill games. So the tabletop company Avalon Hill, they had microcomputer games, and they put them out often in the same box, would be for Apple II and for TRS-80 or something like that. So the big box versions.
Were those, and there's tons of strategy games?
Well, they kind of. Some were strategy, and they also had a number of sort of graphical or text adventure games, that kind of stuff, but lots of strategy ones. So anyway, this same seller, 80s Vault, will have like 10 or 20 different Avalon Hill games for the Apple II sealed inbox available every single month, and has been doing it for like a year now. And I don't understand where they're getting them all. It's crazy.
They had a horde of, if it's them, if it's the same seller, but I know it was in Venezuela, there's a horde of Atari 130 XL or XE, they're the XE, aren't they, computers new in box.
Right.
And at actually a reasonable price. So
and this guy has them all new and sealed. So if you're like a game collector and you're looking for sealed Apple games, and it's a buyer that I've actually purchased from. Now they're sealed in box, and I've yet to. I will be opening them up on the video podcast when it launches later this month or next month. So we'll see. Maybe inside them are just rocks. So like I don't know, but so far they seem to be brand new sealed in box games. And it's crazy.
Very cool.
So it's that same guy, and he's got now two of these. These aren't sealed. These programmer combos for the Atari 800 400, but they do seem to be complete, and they're all fresh and. As he says, fresh from the box, complete the box. So, and the other thing I'm going to suggest, they're currently, and it's got almost 4 days left in the auction, is for $50 and has no bids, an Atari Heavy Sixer. We were talking last episode how the Heavy Sixer is sort of, if you're looking for Atari 2600, the Heavy Sixer is the most collectible one. It's the heavy one.
Oh, it turned out that's what I have, too. I had looked.
There you go, because there's a few different ones that have the six-switch, but switches, you got the you can tell if it's the heavy switch because you pick it up and it's called heavy for a reason. And this one's nice in that it's got the original box. Now this and it's complete. It's got joysticks. It looks pristine. These things usually go for quite a bit more than this. And I don't know whether it's been listed wrong or something. It's under Vintage Game Systems. I don't get it, but there's an Atari CX 2600, the Heavy Sixer, with the original box, all the original bits. It's got like the little logbook that came with it and the warranty card, and it looks completely new, and it's currently going for $50 with no bids. I already have one. But right now, like that's the usually these things will, you know, buy now of $200 or something like that. So they, you know, it's not that they go for thousands, but getting a good one in good condition and with the box and stuff, it should. I don't know why it's got no bids. It's been up for a while. So just nobody's noticing this auction. We'll have a link to it. If you've been holding out looking for a good heavy sixer, like cheap, and no one else spots this might be your chance. So I'm going all Atari this time. Ha ha. Surprised you all. So guys, let's start wrapping things up. Let's talk about what have you been doing? What's up? What's new? People want to know the real you. David, tell us about the real David. What's the real David like?
That's it. I already talked about what I've been up to, so other than my real job.
They want to know why you're such an angry man.
I can't do what I love all the time. That's what I want to do.
Oh,
I want to do shows like this all the time and write and work on old computers.
See,
I don't want to go to real work.
That's part of being retired. We're going to be awesome old guys, and we can just sit around and do this all the time. It'll be awesome.
So my article, that was the big thing. That's the big thing for me. And now I'm trying to promote it. You know, get it picked up on to get into the mainstream. That would be great.
And of course, interviewing everybody on the planet.
Well, I haven't really interviewed anybody since Bob Cook, which was great. You know, John Scully.
Oh, is that all?
Actually, I do have
much. I haven't done much since I interviewed Bob.
I mean, I haven't interviewed anybody else.
Oh, my life is so empty. Look at me. I haven't done John Scully size interviews in a week. Yeah, you slacker.
Tim Cook won't return my calls.
He's too busy making a museum. So do you have anything exciting coming up?
Me and Blake are about to do another not another Apple podcast.
I have been enjoying your shows. What is it? Three episodes now?
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, I'm
three
digging
in the can.
Yeah, I've been liking them very much.
So I can't report we haven't fully decided what the next show will be about yet. But so that's upcoming, and of course I've got to, just like I guess how you guys feel the same way, it's 1 MHz and RetroBits, is Stan Veit podcast is really past due for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I really I need to work on that. So that's a big to-do on my to-do list. But also, yeah, my real world here, like my office is a mess and the garage is a mess, and I really like to get out there and just work with some stuff and play with the old computers. I need to remember to do that.
So yes, it is important to take time to play. Very, very important.
Yes.
So, Earl, what about you?
I've been doing all kinds of stuff. I've been having a lot of retro fun lately.
You got two clubs to go to every month.
I know. There's that. I'll kind of do a segue here. My daughter and
three.
Have been
two Commodore ones, and the Seattle one, right? The retro.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, I had to miss the last Seattle one, unfortunately. I really wanted to go. They were doing a repair time where they got everybody together and put their heads together on fixing old stuff. I got a couple old things I wanted to take up there and see if we could make it work. But next month, we'll see what happens. But yeah, Jessica and I, my daughter, have been doing a lot of 8-bit programming. I gave her my SX64, and so that was nice for her room because it's portable. You know, she can kind of stick it in the corner when she's not using it. She's been learning some assembly language and some basic, and you know, is actually starting to crank out the code. So that's
you are raising her right, Earl. Nice.
Yeah, she says that maybe I'm turning her into a geek, but she says that's cool with her. So
awesome. That is good parenting.
So programming on my end, I'm at the beginning stage of writing a network game for the Commodore 64. There's a device called the Commodore Flyer, and you know, maybe we'll talk more about that in the future in another episode, but this is a really cool device that connects up to the serial port on the Commodore and lets it chat out to the internet. So I want to write a reversey game that you can play reversey with somebody else over the internet, with you both just being on Commodores and having this little internet connection, and you know, no intervening PC or any stinking, you know, modern technology to do it.
Nice.
And I'm going to talk about that process in an upcoming episode of RetroBits, which is the next thing I want to talk about.
What do you say, an upcoming RetroBits?
After about a year hiatus, which is way longer than I originally intended, I'm going to start kicking out RetroBits episodes again. In fact, I will say that before we record another RCR, there will be a new RetroBits on the air.
All right.
And in addition to some of my own stuff that I'm doing, I have an interview that's coming up that I'm very excited about, that since it hasn't actually happened yet, I can't say who, but I can say that if you're a retro computer enthusiast, you know this name and you know the innovations that I'll be talking about, and I'll just leave it like a teaser out there.
Nice.
And I tell you, you know, childhood hero. So I'm really excited to have this interview coming up. But yeah, I'll be excited to be back behind the mic on RetroBits again. It's been way too long.
That's very exciting. I'm looking for. I was always a huge fan. I've listened to all 140 or so shows. So that's exciting that it's coming back. That's me. Were you inspired? Or were you just jealous of David because he wants to have 900 million podcasts?
I think it probably was that. Yeah, I think David was my inspiration. You're the man, David.
Thanks.
Got me back behind the mic here.
I'm starting a network.
Well, it definitely motivates me to get my stuff done. This week in David.
Twid.
That is awesome. Definitely is motivating me because I have been working for months now to try to get the system set up so I can relaunch 1 MHz.
Harder, work harder.
Well, I mean, I'm down to the last little bits of it, so it should launch too. If it doesn't launch in April, I'll be incredibly upset at myself. So it should also launch. So we should have lots of new podcast stuff for everybody listening to. So that's really nice. I love doing this kind of stuff. So very exciting, guys. That's great news, Earl. We're looking forward to that relaunch.
What about you, Carrington?
Oh, I just live in a hole, you know. I live for this show, and I don't exist between hand. It just I sit here in darkness waiting for you to Skype me.
Well, that's sad. I guess we're going to have to Skype you more often.
No, just lots of stuff. Mostly it's been film stuff. I've been helping a bunch of people work on film things. And, in fact, last night I went out to a film premiere. My Double Take podcast co-host was involved in making a film ages ago. It took about 3 years to get done, and it played at Canadian Film Fest last night, so we went to the premiere of that. No, it was awful. It was incredibly beautiful. So the cinematography was amazing, but the script itself was a nightmare of awfulness. It was just like, the worst imaginable. It was terrible. But it was fun to see it. Like she wasn't like the writer or director or anything like that. She did camera stuff and she was an AD, and so it's not, you know, she's not taking the blame for any of it. But it really was. It was horrifically bad.
She's not an actress,
beautifully shot,
though, huh?
No, but she was on screen a few times. Just, you know, indie films, like, yeah. Whenever I'm helping, I'm doing it as well. Oh my god, yeah, like all of us do. Like I've made a lot of little short films and also helped dozens and dozens of my friends, or my friends make dozens and dozens of films. I don't have dozens and dozens of friends. And it's always the case. Like if I'm working sound on a film, you know, you're also going to be working the craft table and playing three roles in them. I just that's the nature of indie filming. So I don't have an IMDb page, but I bet you I've been in 50 different movies, which is like little indie films, which is one of those things. Like I have friends who make short films, so it's, you know, at least once a month or so I'm speaking a line in somebody's kitchen because they want to do a horror movie. So fun stuff. Right before we wrap up, something I found very interesting. I had to go over to Best Buy today to pick up what was I looking for? A cable, something like that. And so it's Saturday, and I was in a hurry, so I'm like, I'll drop in a Best Buy. So I go in there, and I haven't been in a Best Buy for a while. because there's just other places to get cables a lot cheaper, and I'm usually looking for Apple computers, and just it's, you know, not my place, and DVDs are expensive there and that sort of stuff. But I go in this Best Buy and I go to the computer section, and something I noticed this time that I've never seen before in a big box computer store in all the years I've gone into them. The Apple section was packed, crazily packed. And, you know, it's got that small section which shows the Apple computers and got the little section of Apple things. And there was more people in that section than in the regular PC section, which is five times the size. And all these big box stores for years now, since the 90s, have had their little, you know, Mac section. And they've always been the wasteland that, you know, just one Mac diehard is in. I've never before gone in. And I really think it's a harbinger of Apple having, you know, a crazy good year this year or something, because all those people were in there, and the Apple store also in that mall was, you know, standing room only. But I think the fact that Best Buy's and just the regular computer buying public are all walking over there and looking at the Mac computers, not the iPads, that looking at that too, but standing there playing with the MacBook Airs, I really think that's indicative of something. So I just had never seen it before. It really struck me. So I just want to share. It's got nothing to do with retro stuff. Just want to share.
I've actually been to Best Buy a few times lately, and I was pretty happy with the experience, I got to say. We bought our newer television from there and got a good deal. I did some decent research, and we bought their house brand. You know, because we don't spend a lot of money and just, you know.
Sure. What is that? Insignia is there?
No. I always going blank. I'm getting old. I want to say Dyson. Obviously, that's not it, but it's like that.
Dyson. Oh, my goodness. Those are discs. I used to love Dyson discs. What was your favorite? Okay, they're pop quiz, guys. What
but
was your
Insignia,
favorite?
My Five son just got one, too, for his Xbox. And we're
yeah, I've moved on from your TV. I'm asking you a question. What was your favorite 5 1/4-inch floppy disk brand?
Dyson by a mile. I mean, Elephant. The original Dysons.
I mean, Elephant. Those were my two. I was always a Dyson guy, too, but I love my Elephants. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting you two would pick that.
There's also a Gorilla Banana.
Really? The Dysons were the ones that, you know, when the others were $30 a box, the Dysons were $50, and they were just always of a better quality.
Or at least more expensive, but I bought into it. I also was the Dyson guy. I remember that color. I bet you I could pick that color, the Dyson off.
That kind of brown,
brown wine color. I bet you I could pick that out of a big box of crayons. I remember that distinctive color. There's some branding for you.
What's kind of funny is the last big purchase of 5 1/4 diskettes I made, I'm going to put it 1994. Because I moved from El Paso, Texas then. And I still have a bunch of those because I got them at Computer City.
The last purchase I made was about 3 months ago. Just at the end of the year, there's a couple of vintage shops here in Toronto, like electronic surplus places. And that's your go-to place if you're looking for still brand-new sealed inbox copies of like boxes of 10 of a 5 1/4-inch floppy.
There's a place in Toronto that you can go buy 5 1/4-inch discs today?
There's two of them. There's two vintage surplus places, like electronic surplus shops, one on Bloor Street and one down on Queen Street, if people are interested. And both of them will have brand new, like just manufactured recently boxes. They're, you know, I don't know even what the brands are. You can't go buy Dysons anymore or Elephants, but they all work.
That's it.
I bought two boxes of 10 discs, and they all work perfectly. I needed them for a project. So I'm like, where can I get them? Don't have to go online. You can buy them in Toronto. Toronto is awesome. Just saying.
That's it. I mean, it's going to take me a little while to pack my stuff. But, you know, if the CN Tower and the Path didn't do it, then this definitely – this just pushes me over the edge.
Yeah. Two different – I mean, there's probably lots of others. But both of the big electronic surplus stores downtown, they always have them. And that's – you know, I bought them a couple years ago, and I went down, and there they were now. So it was like November or December or whatever. So bought them right before Christmas.
I'm going to go to Toronto one day.
It's awesome. We would welcome you, and we would say A, and we would apologize a lot because that's what Canadians do. Okay, guys, let's wrap it up. We've been on this has gone 300-500 hours.
Gosh.
So it's time. All right. It's time to thank everybody for listening. We really do appreciate them listening and showing support for the show and sending in feedback and hopefully going over to rcrpodcast.com and checking out the site. But most importantly, for subscribing and listening to the show. It means a lot to all three of us. I know. It means a lot to me. It means so much to me. The other two guys don't even matter. It means so much to me. That's all that really matters. You can check us on the blog. Check us out on Twitter, which is at rcrpodcast.com. And ideally, it'd be great if you love the show, if you can leave a little review on iTunes. So I think that helps boost our placement. I'm not really sure. But the most important thing is that you just keep listening and ideally writing in if you've got suggestions or feedback, because we love to hear from you. You can find all the links and stuff like that that we babbled about in our show notes, which will be headed over our new site, rcrpodcast.com. Just click on episodes and you can see this episode, which is number 25. And Yeah, I know. It's exciting that we've done 25 years. So I think, as far as I know, next episode will be the big one-year anniversary. We've gone over a year, but this will be the 1 year with this host set up. So we might do something special for next episode. Who knows? And in the meantime, and until next time, as they say, Retro Compute!
We're now in orbit, steady lasers up, running perfect, starting to collect.